This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowain. Immediately after Thurgood Marshall stepped down from the Supreme Court, the public debate on the confirmation process began. Next month, the Senate begins its part in the procedure when it holds hearings. We asked Walter Dellinger, a constitutional law professor at Duke University, to explain where the court has been going in the last few years and what he sees as its future direction. Dellinger thinks that when the Senate begins its hearings, it should look at its constitutional mandate more closely. He says it's time for the Senate to take a broader role than just checking the professional credentials of the nominee.
The Senate has taken the view that it can also take a candidate's philosophy into account, a candidate's nominee's ideology. But senators are somewhat hesitant to do that. They will variously describe their role as being allowed to vote no if they find a candidate is a dangerous radical, or if they find that he or she is outside the mainstream of legal thought. I think the framers of the Constitution contemplated the Senate not taking such a backseat to the president.
I wonder, though, how much of a backseat is it to be able to say yes or no? And certainly nominees have been rejected. Bork, of course, the most recent one.
It's true. The Senate has rejected the nomination of Judge Bork most dramatically and most recently. The Senate rejected the nomination of Justice A. Portis to be Chief Justice of the United States in 1969. And it rejected Judges Haynesworth and Carswell shortly thereafter. Nonetheless, if you talk to members of the Senate, you often hear them placing a strong burden on those who would oppose a nominee. Senators will say, well, I haven't yet seen a smoking gun. I'm not sure there's any strong disqualification that has emerged about this particular nominee at one time or another. When, in fact, the selection of Supreme Court justices is a matter that the framers thought required the concurrence of two branches of the government, just as is the passage of legislation. When the president vetoes legislation or signs it, the president doesn't defer to the Congress one bit, as far as I can see, whereas there's still a considerable amount of deference given by the Senate to the president.
How important do you think that a member of the Supreme Court have judicial experience before sitting on the court?
Well, I'm not sure that is as important as we have very recently come to think of it. I took a look recently, Marty, at the biographies of the justices who decided the most important 20th century case, Brown versus the Board of Education, ending school segregation. That decision came down on May 17th, 1954, so I decided to take a look at that court and see how its biographies differed from those of the present court. And it was quite striking. Not a single justice on the court that decided Brown versus the Board of Education had ever spent a day as a judge.
What did they?
No prior judicial experience.
What had they been doing?
They'd been doing things that were too important in public life for them to give up to be lower court judges. On that court were three former United States senators, two former attorneys general, two former solicitor general of the United States, the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg war crimes trial. Every single member of that court had been prominent in the public life of the nation before going on the court. You don't give up the governorship of California to go and be a lower court judge. Really starting particularly in 1981, with a series of nominations, the presidents have chosen people who are not generally known to the public.
What does this public life, this life outside the judiciary, then give a member of the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it is something that is sadly lacking for the present court. You don't need, certainly don't need nine members of the court who played major roles in public life. But when you have no one on the court, no one, as is the case presently. You have a court with no member who really understands how the national political process works. It's a court of logicians that seems sometimes out of touch with the reality of life. Justice Thurgood Marshall was the only member of the court who had played a prominent public role, and so now there's none. I think when you have a court, probably the first in our history, in which no member of the court ever served in Congress, I'm not sure they have a sense of how the political process works.
Do you think, though, that the Supreme Court should have a sense about how the political process works? Would that contaminate, do you think, some of their decisions?
I do think. I mean, I think Holmes, Justice Holmes was right when he said the life of the law has not been logic but experience. There's a deep truth in that, and if judges lack much in the way of experience and have only logic, they're missing some of the life of the law. And I'll give you an example. In the 1989 and 90 terms of the Supreme Court, the court reversed its interpretation of a number of points under the federal civil rights statutes from what earlier courts had done. By reinterpreting those acts, they threw that issue back in the political process at a time when our process has been dominated by Willie Horton ads and quota campaigns and sent Congress into something of a maelstrom. I think if there'd been a member of the court who had had more experience in public life, he or she might have said, you know, we ought to hesitate before reexamining these precedents because we're going to set off a very, very, very deep and divisive political process over race if we do that. Everyone would agree, Marty, that when a court is deciding whether or not to maintain old precedents, to follow the doctrine of stare decisis, that inevitably involves an exercise of judgment. How important is the interest of stability in the old doctrine? So when you face questions like that, I think it's useful to have a court that has some experience in public life, or at least has some members that do.
Do you think then it's important for the court, the Supreme Court, to wrestle then with the implications of their decisions on people and their allegiance to the Constitution? Should that be sort of an ongoing argument in the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's the court has to take account of what the impact of its decisions will be. I don't think that is necessarily in tension with its role as a faithful interpreter of the Constitution. So many of the Constitution's broad phrases, like the equal protection of the laws, really require an understanding of how certain measures impact upon people. For example, that we had a recent controversy over abortion counseling regulations, the so-called gag rule. If women who rely upon publicly funded family planning clinics cannot get advice about the possibility of abortion, where does that leave them? Well, some justices said, well, they can just simply go to a private doctor. Others thought that was quite unrealistic, that women who rely upon publicly financed clinics have access to private doctors. So in determining how great a burden a statute like that imposes upon an individual, it's important to have some sense of how people are affected by the work of the court.
Do you think it's a mistake to think of the Supreme Court only in terms of conservative or liberal?
Well, I think it probably is because the nature of the issues changes so greatly. It is very hard to predict the future and the kind of issues that are going to come up a decade from now. And we may not even know what liberal and conservative mean in a different context. I do think there is some baseline aspect of judging that tends to continue in a particular judge over time, and that is whether a judge defers to the state, to the power of government, or not, or the extent to which a judge defers to the government. I think we have on the present court a number of justices who quite consistently over time accept the position of the government over that of the individual, and a dwindling number of justices who demand of the government a very compelling justification before the government interferes with an individual's liberty.
I'm speaking with Walter Dellinger. He's a professor of law at Duke University and specializes in constitutional law. We're talking about the selection process for the Supreme Court. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Dellinger, and he's a professor of law at Duke University. What do you think are the relevant, important questions that a nominee to the Supreme Court should be asked? What's in bounds? What's out of bounds?
All right. That, I think, is one of the toughest issues that constitutional scholars are grappling with. Right off the bat, I'll tell you, it's easy to define what should be ruled out. I think it's not appropriate to ask a nominee, how would you rule in the case of, for example, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, which is on the court's docket, you know, number 9783 next term, in which the state statute requires a married woman to have to give notice to her husband before obtaining an abortion. How will you rule on that case? That seems to me is out of bounds. And the reason it's out of bounds is that the whole notion of an independent judiciary contemplates that a judge will make up his or her mind on the basis of the briefs and the arguments and the statutes that are before the court. And if you ask that kind of question in a confirmation hearing, it certainly has the appearance that you're extracting a political commitment from a judge about how he or she will vote on a particular case.
If you ask them about their judicial philosophy, and that's a very vague notion, I think, will that tell the Senate and then the public something about how this person will rule in the future? And is there a danger then of holding them accountable somehow?
I don't think there is a danger of holding them accountable if everyone understands that what you're trying to ascertain is simply what kind of person this man or woman is. Why not ask a nominee, how do you feel about abortion? How do you react to it? What do you think of the moral dilemmas involved? Or do you believe there are moral dilemmas involved? I don't think it is inappropriate to ask a nominee, to get very specific, do you believe that a woman has an important liberty interest in making her own reproductive decisions? Or do you think that a fertilized ovum or a fetus has constitutional status? Those are two different questions that you could ask a nominee. And a nominee ought to say, now, I may change my view, but here's what I think on those, and that doesn't tell you how I would vote in any particular case, but it gives you a sense of where I'm coming from.
Walter Dellinger is my guest, and he's a professor of law at Duke University and specializes in constitutional law. We're talking now about the upcoming hearings on Clarence Thomas' nomination to the Supreme Court. This, of course, is the seat that has been vacated recently by Justice Thurgood Marshall. When you look at the court's recent rulings, taken as a whole, from things like the gag rule regarding abortion counseling and federally funded planning clinics, about nude dancing not being protected by the First Amendment, about life term for drug possession, they ruled on a particular case, about fetal protection policies being illegal, where would you say the court is taking the country?
Well, I think the court is taking two fairly major steps. First, the court is deferring to the judgments of both the national government and state governments against individual claims, so that, for example, a majority of the court will now accept justifications by the state that many seem as relatively flimsy. For example, in the case in which a young man was given life sentence with no possibility of parole for a first offense of possessing cocaine, the state's argument as to why this was justified was that those people who are often the bottom level mules, couriers in the organization, not big drug kingpins, at least if you give them that kind of sentence, they might rat on you know, higher-ups. Well, the state didn't have much in the way of proof that that had actually happened, but the court was willing to accept the state's word for it. I mean, that's what you see across the board. I think within the national government, you have a court which is tilting strongly in the direction of executive authority, of favoring the power of the president over that of Congress. And a good example of that is in the area of the abortion counseling regulations that prohibit doctors from discussing abortion with the pregnant women who are visiting federally funded planning centers. Congress never passed any such law. Those regulations were adopted by a single administrator in the waning days of the Reagan administration. And most observers thought the court would hold that those regulations simply went beyond the administrator's power, that nothing in the underlying law allowed an administrator to promulgate such regulations. And yet the court, surprisingly, by a 5-4 majority, first held that the administrator did have the power to promulgate those regulations, then upheld them against First Amendment challenge. And now Congress, there are substantial majorities in both houses of Congress to overturn them, but a presidential veto will likely keep them in place. So you see a process in which Congress is being cut out of the lawmaking process, and that's a large trend.
What issues are going to be coming before the Supreme Court later on this year? And I know that abortion is certainly making its way through the courts.
Well, we have, it's going to be a very interesting term. The court is going to be deciding whether it's time to abandon desegregation remedies in the South in an important case from DeKalb County, Georgia, where the school system was once desegregated in 1969. It's been resegregated by population patterns, shifts, and the question is whether the school board has to correct that by using some busing. An important Operation Rescue case up. The Supreme Court is going to hear the very same issue that it's turned out to be very divisive recently in Wichita, Kansas. It's got a case called Jane Bray versus the Alexandria Women's Health Clinic, in which a federal court used a Civil War era statute, the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, as a basis for awarding damages, money damages against an Operation Rescue group that had closed down a women's health clinic in Alexandria, Virginia. And the Supreme Court is going to decide whether that older statute will actually support that judgment or not. And it's a very interesting case because the issue is whether interference with an abortion clinic is an activity which deprives women of equality rights. So the court is going to have to come very close to struggling with this issue in that case. Oh, I'll tell you the case that I think will be interesting to just about every American. The court has a seemingly trivial case that could be very important in the area of religious practices in the schools. The case is from Rhode Island. It's called Lee versus Weissman. And the issue is whether a public school may have a prayer in the form of a benediction at its graduation ceremony. And graduation prayers in public schools are a fighting issue, particularly throughout the South and the Midwest. And the lower courts held that under the court's school prayer decision, the government itself could not promote and sponsor a prayer. And what's at issue is if the Supreme Court allows graduation prayers, how far will they go? How far will they indicate they're going to go in admitting government-composed or government-sponsored prayers back into the public school system? So I think that's one that's going to cause a lot of interest.
You seem to be describing lots of old issues wearing new clothing.
Oh, that's a nice insight. It is certainly true. When you teach constitutional law, as I have for just about 20 years. What is interesting now is the court has gotten more conservative. People are bringing old issues back to the court that were once thought settled, so that I tend to be revisiting as a constitutional law professor issues that were decided and are now up to be decided all over again. I thought we were through with the school prayer issue, for example. I thought that would have been settled by the Supreme Court back in the early 1960s. But now it's back again, and all the old favorites seem to be coming back just with different answers.
So you can kind of dust off some of your old notebooks, I guess.
Well, I guess I can give the same old exams. It's just that I'll change the, you know, the correct answer changes.
Is this an interesting time for a professor of law who specializes in the Constitution to live?
I suppose it is, though I must admit I was something of a child of the Warren Court. I clerked for Justice Hugo Black in 1968-69, which was the last year that Chief Justice Earl Warren served, and I guess I didn't think I would be teaching the undoing of some of those cases to the extent that I am 20 years later. So it's interesting. It makes for busy summers when Supreme Court justices retire. I would wish we could have one summer of peace and quiet without a confirmation process.
Well, I thank you very much, Walter Dellinger, for your time today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Walter Dellinger teaches constitutional law at Duke University. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.